Hi, and welcome to this week's reading of the New York Times Magazine. I'm Frankie Goldfarb, and for the next hour, I will be reading from the March 24th, 2024 issue. The first article is the cover story, and it's titled The Secrets of Isla de Mona, A Journey to the Mysterious Island Where Migrants, Pilgrims, and Seekers Have Washed Up for Centuries. The whole issue is called The Voyages Issued. Every year, I spend a month or two in Puerto Rico, where my mother's family is from. Often I go in winter with the other snowbirds, finding solace amongst the palm trees. But I'm not a tourist, not really. I track the developers that privatize the shoreline. I follow the environmental reports that give our beaches a failing grade. I'm disenchanted with the island of enchantment, suspicious of an image that obscures the unglamorous conditions of daily life. Frequent blackouts, meager public services, a rental market ravaged by Airbnb. Maybe that's why I turned away from the sunshine and started to explore caves with my friends Raymond and Xavier, seeking out wonders not yet packaged for the visitor's economy. I've been learning to love stalactites and squeaking bats, black snakes, and cloistered waterfalls, even slowly the darkness itself. The Greater Antilles and the Yucatan Peninsula form one of the most cavernous regions in the world, and many of these grottos contain pre-colonial inscriptions. But no other site can match the density of designs found on Mona, a semi-arid mesa halfway between Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic. The island is ringed by sheer cliffs and honeycombed with miles of subterranean passageways. Most of the inscriptions are tucked away in the so-called dark zone, far from access to the upper world, congregating around rare pools of fresh water. More accessible chambers, harbor other histories, an icon vase filled with gold coins, shards of Spanish olive jars stained with the oldest wine in the Americas. In one cave, a foreign visitor from the 16th century carved a kind of commentary alongside ancient petroglyphs, Plurifecit Deus, which translates to God made many things. I kept repeating the phrase to myself like a mantra, trying to impose divine order on the contradictions of the new world, the only world I've ever known. Mona now, and then in quotes, the word belongs to Puerto Rico and thus to the United States. But the island has always retained a certain rugged self-possession, rising fatherless and fully formed from the sea like an American Aphrodite. The archaeologist Ovidio Davila famously described the island as a floating fortress, remote, inhospitable, an arsenal of mysteries. But Mona also teems with life. Flowering cactuses, swirling flocks of seabirds, orchids and iguanas and frogs found nowhere else on the earth. Hawksbill turtles from as far away as Panama crawl on shore to nest under the summer moon. Enormous basket sponges and Gregorian corals cling to the seawall. Many migrant species rarely seen from Puerto Rico proper come close to shore. Dolphins, pilot whales, tiger sharks, bluefin tuna, flying fish. Mona's remote beaches receive tribute from faraway waters, as if this might be the secret center of the world. But for many Puerto Ricans, Mona is a legendary backwater, the punchline for a whole genre of jokes. Quote, your political enemies couldn't even win the mayor's race on Mona. The socialists should go live with the iguanas. The Supreme Court might consider setting up its little theocracy over there. Like Robinson Crusoe, even locals who should know better view this other island as a blank slate for exile or utopia. Of course, Mona wasn't always an abstraction. Before Europeans wandered west, indigenous people settled the island as early as 3000 BC. When Columbus first came to Mona in 1494, there was a community cultivating a marvelous variety of fruits and tubers with a thin fringe of arable soil on the island's western side. Indigenous people continued to survive on Mona for another 100 years, much longer than anywhere else in the region, taking refuge in the island's mysterious interior. Since then, the island has hosted a vivid procession of conquistadors, conversos, Maroons, priests, pirates, prisoners, guano miners, military men, treasure hunters, scientists, and refugees. Now, Mona is a protected nature reserve, and the only residents are park rangers. Researchers and amateurs alike must apply for a permit from Puerto Rico's Department of Natural and Environmental Resources in order to travel there. Hunters come to subdue the feral descendants of goats and pigs introduced by the Spanish. Scuba divers wander the reefs. But the Mona Passage, fast-flowing, shark-infested, one of the roughest stretches of water in the world, remains a troubled crucible of imperial traffic. Every year, migrants from Cuba, Haiti, and the Dominican Republic crowd small boats and try to make the dangerous crossing to Puerto Rico, the local gateway to the American dream. Many drown, unaccountable bodies at the bottom of the sea. Hundreds wind up stranded on Mona, abandoned by smugglers looking to cut corners on the journey, then deported by authorities within days. Even those who visit Mona for recreation sometimes stumble into the island's traps. In 2001, a Boy Scout got lost and died of dehydration. Just last month, a hunter disappeared near a well-known cave not far from camp. Why did these frightening stories seduce me? If so many people were willing to suffer the island's torments, I figured they must be suffering for something. Freedom, beauty, maybe even wisdom. The travel industry sells the Caribbean as a gentle paradise where the workers of the first world can escape to rest at last on the shores of an infinite resort. But Mona remains incompletely mastered, a wilderness where you won't be welcomed, where it's still possible to lose your way and lose your life. The curious world, Thoreau wrote, this quote, is more wonderful than convenient. And his words came to me as I gathered my hiking boots and helmet, laxatives and Dramamine, batteries, baby wipes, and safety wardrobe of neon orange. After nearly a year of bureaucratic tribulations, I was finally going to Mona. The two most popular tour companies never wrote me back, so I planned the trip with Jamie Zamora, a freelance guide who has been exploring the island for more than 40 years. But it was better this way. I liked the purity of his passion and his disdain for institutions. Instead of a website or brochure, he directed me to a private Facebook group where he maintained a meticulous archive of old maps, news clippings, and personal photographs of articles he found on the island. A creamy conch shell with a hole drilled through it, the ornamental handles of a broken urn. In December, the stars suddenly aligned. Our permits were approved, the seas calmed, and we pulled the team together. I crossed Midtown with cash in my coat to wire to a boat captain named Mikey. My friends Raymond and Xavier came through. So did my friend Alyssa. Our photographer Chris would bring his partner Andrea. Jamie recruited some old comrades, Chito Manuel and Charlito the cook. The ecologist Hector Quintero, known as Quinique, signed on and suggested we might invite Tony Neves, who had recently retired from 33 years as Mona Island's director. Finally, Jamie texted to say the moon would be full for our visit. In 1 week, he promised, your magic will begin to shine. The boats arrived at the pier in Joyuda on the western shore of Puerto Rico near dawn. We were relieved to discover that the sea was quiet. Plancho, the captain said, like an iron sheet, only this gracious once or twice a year. He warned me not to get the wrong impression. Mona no es así. Still, I could feel it when we crossed into the Mona Passage proper, where the waters of the Atlantic and the Caribbean come together in a cauldron of treacherous cross currents. The prow began to jump across the waves, so that we had to brace hard against the railing to keep our tailbones from bruising. I realized I have never been this close to the water for this long. I always approached Puerto Rico from above and tried to imagine the first people who came this way, rowing with no land in sight, searching the sky for congregations of clouds, the sign of green things breathing. Over the last several years, I'd been unlearning the standard narrative about pre-colonial history. In Puerto Rico, the Department of Education still promotes the tired narrative that the people who greeted Columbus were simple and docile with a rudimentary culture. But Reniel Rodriguez, an archaeologist, told me that the recent research is very clear. The migrants who left Central America and the Amazon basin to populate our archipelago were great mariners, like the Polynesians, navigating by stars and currents and wind patterns. Over generations of migration, they formed multi-ethnic politics and polities and maintained vast trade networks. Jade from Guatemala, gold and copper alloys from Colombia, jaguar's teeth from continental jungles. None of these materials arrived by accident. As we bumped along, I wondered what it was like to bring, say, a passel of guinea pigs from Colombia to Puerto Rico in the bottom of a wide canoe. The oldest carbon-dated evidence of human habitation on Mona dates from about 2800 BC. They were probably attracted to the island's majestic underworld. Indigenous mythology names symbolic caves as the great cosmic incubators, giving birth to the moon, the sun, and the archipelago's first people. Mona's residents filled the caves with signs. The island was never a land of milk and honey, so its importance must have been strategic and spiritual rather than strictly productive. Oviedo de Villa imagines a meeting point and tribal crossroads, hosting chiefs and traders, parliaments and pilgrimages. The rigor of the journey to Mona conferred a kind of gravity on every human drama that unfolded on the mesa's barren stage. It took a long while for Puerto Rico to fall out of view, and hours more for Mona to appear, so that I felt suspended in time as well as space. I could imagine the Spanish ships prowling the Caribbean, snatching people from the Lesser Antilles and the coast of South America to replenish their depleted workforce. I could imagine the first coffle of stolen Africans would arrive in Santo Domingo. This passage still teems with human traffic. No one who worked these waters, our captain, the Coast Guard, local fishermen, wanted to talk to me about what they'd seen. Edouard Glissant was right. Even the brightest voyages bring to mind the depths of the sea, quote, with their punctuation of scarcely corroded balls and chains, end quote. I had taken off my glasses, foggy from the spray, so at first I wasn't sure if the smudge of cream in the corner of my eye was just a trick of light. But then Kukik pointed in the direction, and the distant citadel began to shine. First the pale naked flanks of the highest cliffs, and then slowly the region shadowed with underbrush. The island shape sharpened, a thin slice of stone floating like a cataract on the dark iris of the sea. When we finally moored at Playa Pajaros, I woke up from my pre-colonial daydream. The beach was covered in trash. Kukik blamed austerity. The Department of Natural and Environmental Resources, like all government agencies, had been defunded to prioritize the debt. There wasn't money anymore to service the island properly. The rangers live on the other side at Playa Sardinier, so our camp, Playa Pajores, was wilder, both more private and more neglected. I was ashamed of my disappointment, realizing that it revealed some measure of willful naivete. I knew the currents of the Mona Passage carried seeds and shells from far-off places, so why not choose plastic bottles and rubber tubing? Still, there were hermit crabs and lizards creeping amongst the sea grapes, as there had been for millions of years, and wild cotton along the edges of the cliffs. Raymond helped me hang my nylon hammock from two sturdy trees, and I thought of the cotton slings, hamaca, an Arawak word, woven by the people of Mona, so finely made that the Spanish set them to work as suppliers for the imperial machine. I had never slept in a hammock before, but after the roughness of the voyage, it felt natural to sway gently, and I dropped into a deep slumber for an hour until I could hear Jamie pacing and singing, summoning us to our first cave. If there had ever been a trail to Cuevo Caballo, there wasn't any more, so we had to shake the sleep from our senses in order to climb, almost crawl, through thorn bushes and over jagged limestone up towards the mouth of the cave. I was surprised to find a paved road just inside, punctuated by the rusted remains of carts and rails. Tony explained how Cuevo Caballo was mined for guano in the 19th century, when Western powers realized the nitrates in bat feces made it very good for gunpowder and fertilizer. The workers slept right here amongst piles of excrement dredged up from the darkness. Eventually, they went on strike for lack of water. There was still fresh guano in Cuevo Caballo, the color and texture of finely ground coffee, and the smell of pneumonia saturated the tighter chambers, so that we passed through them quickly and sought out crevices in the stone where we could catch currents of fresh air. Hay un chorro de formaciones, Jamie said, and it was true. The walls of the cave seemed to undulate with water, and a glistening white powder frosted the figures, crystallizing in chandeliers and sliding over smooth hills of stone, like a gown over the hips of a beauty queen. Sorbetto, Tony told me it was called, as Jamie moved through the caves seeking his favorite freestanding sculptures and addressing them by his own private names. Huevo Frito, Dragon. He was looking for pearls, the perfect mineral spheres that form over centuries in pools beneath the dripping stalactites, especially one particular pearl he called La Cabeza, La Perla Más Hermosa de Toda la Isla. Tony, subtly competing, told me that he had walked through every chamber in this caves to completo, and it was the only one he never lost his way on the way to Mona. On Mona. Still, after many decades, I could see how Jamie and Tony hesitated between branching passageways, retreating into memory's inner topography before disappearing behind a blind curve. So many of the conversations I caught on tape were merely directional. Vamos pala. No más adelante. ¿Y dónde esté Javier? crosstalk, muffle laughter. Jamie told me they sometimes stumbled upon skeletons of goats that died lost in the labyrinth. We learned to listen for one another's voices. In Cuevo Caballo, Jamie cried out, Sila Robahan, Tony. And when we found him, he was kneeling in front of what looked like an empty altar. La Cabeza, a glittering stone in the shape of a skull on a slender neck, had been carefully decapitated. There was a market for that kind of thing. Manuel said he had seen small-time hustlers selling stalactites on the roadside in the Dominican Republic. Even in the dim light of our headlamps, I could see Jamie's face turn red, and I was worried he might cry. Yola adoraba, he explained, helplessly using the word that blurs the boundary between love and worship. If I were an Indian, this would be sacred for me, he said. The older men of our group often spoke as if they had taken the place of indigenous people. Jamie wore a necklace strung with three finely polished beads of stone and shell that he took from a cave years ago. Chito analyzed our dynamics as a clan, and Kikuku summoned scientific theories. Had I heard of epigenetics? How Native Americans transmitted the traumas of starvation, displacement, and genocide across generations? Puerto Ricans, he continued, must be carrying our own ghosts. I was wary of these analogies, but I could also understand their emotional logic. Our guides had lived through El Carpetio, the U.S. government's campaign against the Puerto Rican independence movement, when activists were surveilled and imprisoned, when close comrades turned out to be snitches. They were nostalgic for whatever came before the colonial encounter, when the islands they loved were sovereign. When we got back from Mona, Kike gave me a thumb drive of scientific documents and a short essay he wrote himself, simply titled, Colonies Are There to Be Exploited. I struggled to absorb the intensity of information directed at me. Elisa, often at my side, said it was like standing next to a fire hose. Buried treasure, political intrigue, grand theories, deaths and disappearances. I was missing so much, but at least I could record the poetic names and properties of local plants. Tourist tree for its red and peeling bark. The cactus called Snowball for its crown of white fuzz and thorns. The plumeria called Alhili Cimarron. In the mornings when it bloomed, you could close your eyes and almost find your way across the island by following its fugitive perfume. Tobacco Marino, rolled and smoked, might get you a little high. Chimcharam, Higo Chumba, Coca Falsa. Jamie and Tony often referred to the same refrain, only on Mona. Some of these species were immediately striking. The Mona land iguanas were enormous, with the terrible dignity of dinosaurs, and we had to fight them off whenever we took sponge baths by the cisterns. Others seem modest, enchanted only by the spell of our attention. On the long, hot walk to the ruined lighthouse, Jamie and Tony peeled off, and Chito told me they were tired and had gone back to camp. But on our way back, hours later, we came upon Jamie sitting in a patch of meager shade along the road. Our guides had finally found Fischilis monense, Mona's Island's endemic orchid, and Jamie was waiting to introduce us to this natural wonder. Last time he was on Mona, he spent an afternoon searching in vain. But this time just for us, she had revealed herself and would step into her stardom. Jamie had been so patient, had shown such fortitude, and now he was almost trembling with urgency as he guided us to the spot off-road that he had marked with his staff so he wouldn't lose the little flower. The flower was indeed so little that I almost missed her. A bit of pale silk no larger than my thumbnail on the end of a long bare stem. When I bent the stem toward me to specify her beauty, a purple striped calyx, a clutch of green buds, I was worried it might snap. The tiniest dancer. How strange, I thought, to be so rare and lonely, endemic, endangered, the only flower in the stony field, and at the same time so unremarkable. Or was my own perceptive power unremarkable? My own capacity for feeling? Sometimes reading research papers on Mona, I was baffled by the effort people made to catalog the most minute phenomena. The scientists in scuba gear who explored a dangerous underwater chamber in order to photograph the curious case of a cave-dwelling shrimp called Popeye. But I knew that the argument for protecting Mona depended on the meticulous accumulation of empirical evidence for the island's singularity. And that love is not love without detail, without risk, without a touch of madness. I tried to bring the intensity of attention I had seen among our guides to the library. So much of my formal informal education had rushed through the conquest of the Caribbean, especially Puerto Rico, as if the Spanish and then American invasions had been so successful that they erased not only the history of those who came before, but also the muddy footprints of their own trajectory. Many primary sources confirmed the familiar narrative of unrelenting violence. The archaeologist Alice Sampson drew my attention to an inventory of merchandise from Mona. Shackles with a prisoner attached. But reading the colonial chronicles, I also felt a strange suspense, as if these encounters might have gone another way, as if the future I am living now had not yet been foretold. Mona's particular history dramatized the chaos and contingency of those early decades. The island's location on the route between Santo Domingo and Spain made it a crucial supply station, an entrepot for slave trading. Juan Ponce de Leon imported roughly 80 captives to ramp up production of pan casabe, the durable flatbread made from yuca that was a staple of the indigenous diet. Soon, Mona became the breadbasket for the whole colonial campaign. Gold mines in Puerto Rico, armadas cruising for slaves, salt and pearls from Aruba to Venezuela. The women of Mona manufactured cotton ropes that might have been used, I can only speculate, to hoist sails, corral horses, and bind the wrists of child brides. But even at this high point of exploitation, Mona retained an ambivalent independence. Very few Spaniards took up residence. Instead, they installed indigenous overseers and left the fragmented community to find its own working rhythm, to sustain traditions and experiment with new religions. Many of these people, colonizers, Native Islanders, and captives from different territories, would not have had a common language. Together, they had to learn to grapple with their new position at the center of apocalyptic change. They brokered deals with English and French raiders. They formed Creole families, and they fled the violence of the island's coasts for caves in the interior, not far from the ceremonial ball courts. Mona was never abandoned for long. Exiled islanders returned to fish, forage, and visit sacred sites as their ancestors did for thousands of years. Sailors sick with scurvy came to gather oranges gone to seed. All through the 17th and 18th centuries, pirates frequented the island, making the surrounding waters some of the most perilous in the Atlantic world. The researcher Walter Cardona told me how Blackbeard, the notorious English buccaneer, used Mona to barrack twice stolen Africans, reselling them on the black market once they became acclimated to hard labor. Acclimated is a word in quotes. At the height of the Haitian Revolution, rebels moored ships along Mona's coasts. The island had become both a prison and a sanctuary. Contested terrain where empires' exiles hashed out new identities. In a recent article, Cardona included a photograph that Tony took of a skeleton recovered from Sardinera. DNA testing revealed a young man of African and Arawak ancestry, just a teenager when he died, maybe a Maroon himself. Or maybe this was just wistful thinking, my desire for a story with a taste of freedom in it. Something about the photograph, the arrangement of bones, the knowledge that Tony had touched them, made the limits of my reading oblivious. I had come to Mona to go beyond the syllabus, and wasn't it already working? Every feather and every grain of sand seemed like evidence. Every jagged window framing the sea looked like a wound torn open. Even the drooping casuarinas, imitation pines imported from Australia, seemed to lament their own story of displacement and adaptation. But there was one cave on Mona I still wanted to visit. Maybe seeing colonial signatures in stone would help me bridge the gap between the authority of documents and the testimony of the senses. I will have to start reading this very long article now in order to have time for another article. The next article is by Paul Tough, T-O-U-G-H. It's titled, We Traveled So My 13-Year-Old Could Practice the Language, But He Taught Me Something Deeper. This is about Russia. Even as a little kid, my son Max had a way of immersing himself in the subjects he cared about. The first one I can remember was Thomas the Tank Engine. Max had a hand-me-down wooden train track set up on a low platform in our living room. And at age 3, he would spend hours toddling around the outside, pushing trains and telling made-up stories, lost in the world of Thomas and Percy and Gordon. Hamilton came next, the soundtrack on repeat in the car for months, and then a brief but intense dive into Mixels, a discontinued Lego collection, and then another into Roblox game called Bee Swarm Simulator. With each one, Max would go deep, finding satisfaction not just in the playing, but also in the experience of plunging himself into a new and unfamiliar world and mastering all of its contours. When he wanted company on these journeys, I was often the one who went along. I logged serious hours by his side, shunting wooden trains onto sidings and leading my digital bees on a search for pollen. I hunted down old Lego packs for him on eBay and took him to Washington to see the Jefferson Memorial. I occasionally would try to steer him away from the video games and towards the history books, but mostly it didn't matter what I thought. His interests were his interests, and he explored them the way he wanted, not the way I did. There was a part of me that felt proud of his deep dives, but if I'm being honest, they often made me uneasy. When you're a kid, knowing a ton about obscure subjects can be an early sign of intellectual curiosity, but just as often, it can be a symptom of misfiring neurons, an omen of future mental struggles. Sometimes the child who can tell you everything there is to know about dinosaurs or baseball statistics or the solar system grows up to be a groundbreaking scientist or brilliant entrepreneurs. Sometimes he just grows up to be a guy who never moves out of his parents' basement. As Max got older, his explorations grew more solitary, which led me to a new worry, that his interests were pulling him away from his fellow humans rather than towards them. To protect his future privacy, I'm calling him by his middle name in this article. Max was always a shy kid, slow to warm up to new people, and content to spend long stretches on his own. The pandemic, which hit when he was 10, didn't help. Academically, remote school worked out fine for Max, but socially it added to his isolation. When in-person classes began again, he kept to himself more than ever, quiet behind his mask. At home with his family, he was thoughtful and funny and quick, telling stories and asking endless questions. But when he got to school in the morning, it was like a curtain came down between him and the world. A new subject came along in those pandemic years to once again capture his imagination. Birds. Who knows why? Maybe creatures that could fly and soar were an appealing notion during endless lockdowns. Or maybe birds were just another vast universe for him to map. In Texas, where we live, there are 47 species of warblers alone, each with its own markings and songs and migration patterns to analyze and commit to memory. Max borrowed bird books from the library and lay in bed reading them, absorbing facts and patterns, gathering arcane knowledge. He hung out on nature websites, posting photos and trading ideas with birders many times his age. He walked through fields at dawn, binoculars in hand. Once again, he descended, or maybe ascended this time, and once again I followed him. We spent many weekend mornings together walking beside the lagoons of our local sewage treatment plant, looking for ruby-crowned kinglets and crested caracacaris. I like, too, that bird watching connected him with other people, mostly people in their 60s and 70s, sure, but still people. We joined our local Audubon chapter and went on group hikes through local cemeteries and nature preserves. While everyone else watched birds, I watched Max. When he and I were out in the world together, I felt like it was my job to serve as his translator, speaking up for him when he seemed shy or tongue-tied, nudging him forward when he was hanging back. Among his fellow birders, though, he began to find his own way into conversations, sharing sightings, asking for help with identifications, weighing in on the distinction between cliff swallows and cave swallows. On the way home in the car, he would talk to me about birds, and I would talk to him about people, why they like eye contact, what questions you can ask them if you want to keep a conversation going. My work as a translator sometimes went both ways. Over Christmas break when he was 12, Max's curiosity led him in a new direction. He started learning Russian. I don't know why he chose Russian, and if you ask him, he doesn't have a good answer either. Our family is not Russian. We don't have any Russian friends. It's possible that the absurdity of the pursuit was exactly what appealed to him about it. Whatever his motivation, he began practicing on a language app for an hour a day, sometimes more. And by New Year's, he knew all the Cyrillic letters, every backward R and N. In a few weeks, he could recite simple sentences. My wife and I would walk past his room and hear him repeating Russian phrases into his iPad in a low monotone. It was like living with a 12-year-old spy. He biked to the main library downtown and took out a Russian dictionary, and then biked back a week later for a book of Russian grammar and a history of the czars. Another deep dive was underway. That fall, Max enrolled in a Russian language school that met on Sunday afternoons at a Methodist church in Northwest Austin. Apart from Max, the students were mainly children of recent Russian immigrants, and for them and their parents, the school was a way to keep their culture alive in an alien land. Each week, their tribe would gather, a few dozen blonde, round-faced children playing chess and practicing Russian penmanship, while the parents set up steam tables and sold each other piping hot pirushkis, reminiscing about Moscow winters while sheltering from the blazing Texas sun. During the week in his regular school, Max was still keeping a cautious distance from his classmates. But in Russian school, he was a different person. Friendly, confident, speaking up in class in Russian, chatting up the other kids in the hallway in Russian. At the end of each Sunday, he would emerge from the church doors wearing a shy smile. Driving him home one Sunday afternoon, I asked him to help me understand this mystery. Why did he feel so much more comfortable amongst the students at Russian school than the ones at his actual school? And he replied without a hint of irony, because they're more like me. I didn't see how that could possibly be true, but somehow it felt true to Max. Was it their gloomy Slavic fatalism, their love of borscht? Or was it that they, like Max, spent their days trying to find their way in a strange and foreign land, a place whose customs sometimes seemed bizarre and impenetrable? I still had my worries, as I always did when Max descended into a new realm, but this time did seem different, as if Russian might be taking him toward human connection rather than away from it. He discovered that his English teacher had in school was born in Belarus and asked her if they could start meeting once a week to speak Russian together. She introduced him to Russian poetry and literature, and soon he was heading back to the library for books by Anna Akhmatova and Mikhail Bulgakov. He found a Russian conversation hour at the University of Texas and began to show up on campus once a week to play Cyrillic Scrabble with a handful of undergrads on the couches outside the Slavic Studies department. Walking one day through the Austin airport, he peeled off from our family when he heard someone speaking Russian. We found him at the Taco Deli next to Gate 23, deep in conversation with a family of Kazakhs. Max and I began to talk vaguely about taking a trip to a place where he could try out his Russian for real. I had never been particularly drawn to the countries of the former Soviet Union, but as we talked, the idea of a trip grew on me. If spending his Sunday afternoon speaking Russian made Max feel more alive and less alone, what would it be like for him to be surrounded by the language? In the back of my mind was the fact that Max, now 13, the age when young men and their fathers often begun to pull apart, and I didn't want to miss our last chance for an adventure together. The war in Ukraine had made it impossible for us to think about visiting Russia or Ukraine or Belarus. But Estonia had plenty of Russian speakers, Max informed me, and so did Georgia. Then one afternoon, he peered at me from over the top of a world atlas. What about Uzbekistan? A few months later, there we were, riding into Samarkand from the airport in a $4 taxi. Dawn was breaking, and Max was staring out the window at the minarets and mini-marts and Soviet-era apartment blocks, a big grin on his face, translating the Russian language shop signs for me. "I can't believe we're really here," he said, turning to me. "Are you seeing all this?" In the past, flying would sometimes bring out Max's anxious side, but arriving in Uzbekistan seemed to produce in him a deep sense of calm. He looked relaxed and content, certain that here in this ancient, foreign, rundown city, nothing could possibly go wrong. I, by contrast, was distracted by thoughts of everything that could go wrong on this trip, and indeed by what already had. The airline had managed to leave my suitcase in Houston. Also, my iPhone screen seemed to be cracked, and I was thousands of miles from the nearest Apple store. Also, the only person I could turn to for help was 13 years old. From the beginning, it seemed a little risky, this idea of traveling halfway around the world to a place where I couldn't speak to anyone but Max. The reality was that he and I often drove each other crazy. We argued a lot. The enthusiasm he showed when he was mastering a new subject could quickly turn into frustration when things didn't work out exactly right. Early in his Russian studies, he realized he couldn't roll his R's properly, and he spent many angry hours staring at his tongue in the mirror, trying to will it into Slavic trill, furious at its lazy Western ways. He didn't like talking about the intense feelings he sometimes experienced. So instead, at home, he would often take out his anger on me or his mother, or more often on his little brother, which would spark my own fury. My temper was just as short as his, and neither of us liked to back down. Our blow-ups were sometimes followed by icy silences that could last for days. Things were better usually when we went on trips together. When it was just the two of us, our disagreements and the stress we caused each other would recede. Max was curious about everything, and when we were driving or stopped somewhere for dinner, he would grill me about our friends or our extended family, or about the Cold War, or about how the stock market worked. He was a keen observer of whatever was around us, not just birds, but also people and billboards and menus. And if I was lucky, he would share those insights and oddball theories with me. Those hours when our guard was down and we were just trading stories and make each other laugh were some of my favorite moments. So together we planned a two-week trip with an itinerary that would begin in Samarkand and include stops in Tashkent, Uzbekistan's capital, as well as Almaty, the biggest city in neighboring Kazakhstan. On his last day of middle school, I picked Max up in an Uber, and we went straight to the airport. Our flights from Austin, Samarkand, took a total of 24 hours, and I spent the time either sleeping or in a state of agitation. Usually when Max and I traveled together, I felt responsible for him, not just in the standard keep your kid alive sense, but responsible for his mood, for his mind, for his emotional well-being. On this trip, however, our roles had reversed. "Everything's going to be fine," Max told me, and that was supposed to be my line. Well, that's it for this week's reading of the New York Times Magazine. I've been reading from the March 24th, 2024 issue. I'm Frankie Goldfarb. Have a great day, and thanks for listening to Chris.